Chapter 5. We can't end overdoses until we end poverty and racism. Tom Wolfe was married with two children and worked a good, if mundane, job with San Francisco city government when he got hooked on opioid pain pills. His doctor had prescribed them after foot surgery. In the spring of 2017, after Tom's prescription ran out, he Googled where to buy opioids and discovered that he could do so on Pill Hill, which is the intersection of Hyde and Golden Gate Avenue in the Tenderloin. To maintain his addiction, he sometimes spent his entire paycheck on drugs and stopped paying bills, including the mortgage, and stole his wife's debit card. He estimates he spent a total of $100,000 on pills. Eventually, he switched to heroin, which is much cheaper than pills, snorting it in the bathroom at work and passing out on his desk. He stopped going to work. Pacific Gas and Electric turned off the power to his house. He fled the house for an 11-day bender in the Tenderloin. His wife filed a missing persons report, and a police officer found him. Tom's wife gave him an ultimatum to either get drug treatment or leave the family. He decided to abandon his family and become homeless. "Addiction is the only disease that I know of that actually tells you to make it worse," he told me. "I remember sitting in my garage after I had bought a bunch of OxyContin and thinking, fuck it, I'm just going to be an addict." For the next 6 months, Tom lived on the streets. He smoked fentanyl. He woke up beside people who had overdosed and died. He saw people develop skin abscesses from shooting low-grade heroin. At one point, he was hospitalized for 6 days for sepsis, after missing veins while injecting. "And that still wasn't enough for me to stop," he said. Tom became desperate. After he had been arrested multiple times by the police, the drug dealers would no longer use him as a mule to hold the drugs they sold. He started shoplifting from drug stores and selling the merchandise. The last time he was arrested, in June 2018, he had promised his son he was going to an AA meeting. He smoked crack instead and cried with shame. Later, even though he was wearing a court-ordered monitor around his ankle, and was supposed to stay away from the Tenderloin, he went there anyway. Notified by his ankle monitor that he was in the area, the police arrested him. Tom's abandonment of his family isn't unusual. People often end up homeless after losing their jobs and relationships with friends and family in a desperate effort to support their addictions. "I had a very good friend," a meth dealer told a reporter. "I knew her husband and I knew her kids. Her kids were still small at the time. I smoked her out with meth and smoked her out and smoked her out, and she started buying it for me here and there. About 7 months later, she gives her kids to her mom and starts hauling her pussy out on the street. I know people say God forgives you and time heals all, but I know I'm going to have to answer for that one." Around 2013, Adam Mesnick, a chef and restaurant owner in San Francisco, got to know some of the homeless people who hung around his restaurant, the Deli Board. "I was in there because I wasn't trying to violate their trust or piss them off," he told me. "I was pretty much just hanging out smoking pot with them." "So when Deli Board closes, you go out, smoke a couple of pipe bowls of marijuana, and they were shooting up and you just chit-chat with them and hang out?" I asked. "I had to understand what the heck was going on," he said. "I didn't really understand. I didn't understand it. Now I get it." "What did you get?" "They just come here to die," said Adam. "That's it. They come here to shoot up, nod, and die. That's it. This is not any other place but to come to die. They'll all tell you that. They've all told me that." "They say die?" I asked. "Of course they do," Adam said. "You can see it in some of my interviews. Homeless fentanyl user Jessica tells me on the camera exactly how it is. She smokes fentanyl. She tells you, everyone's here to die. She tells you, everyone ODs. She tells you, everyone boosts. She'll tell you everything." "But is die slang or literal?" I asked. I don't know, he said. But they say that explicitly? I pressed. I come here to die? They explicitly say that, he said. Look at Jessica's interviews. Jessica's telling me about how she died 17 times from doing fentanyl and then they Narcaned. Addiction disaffiliates. When I was an addict, said Vicky Westbrook, I had lost touch with all of my spirituality. To me, spirituality is the connectedness that we all are with each other, with nature, with everything, right? I had lost that. When I tell you that addiction is very isolating, it's so much more than the fact that people want to use by themselves and go in some cubbyhole, right? They're disconnected from everything, right? Themselves, other people, the world, the environment. Even if they're around people, there is isolation and disconnection. Adam says witnessing the effects of addiction on his homeless friends has taken its toll on him. It cannot be healthy for me to see what I see, he said. I couldn't tell you a day when I didn't see someone either smoking fentanyl or shooting up or taking a shit on my block. And it wears on you. I'm sort of not kidding when I say that the city owes me an apology. I asked Chris Herring how he coped psychologically. My advisor is more of, you gotta tough it out. Other advice is, you've got to just start drinking more. I couldn't explain this away or become numb to it in the sense that you're not the primary traumatic. You're not the one who is directly experiencing the trauma. But that proximity really wears on you. Vicky Westbrook went on and off meth. When it was time for me to go back to work, I got a job with another company in tech support and started using again. I'd be in my office with the door closed, smoking dope, meth, listening to phone calls to see if they were doing what they were supposed to. I eventually got fired not because I was smoking dope, but because I had those things that also come with being an addict. You have no self-esteem, but you're also arrogant. After she lost her job, Vicky made the fateful decision to start selling drugs. One of the people that I had been selling to moved to Michigan, and she needed somebody to be a distributor. It was sweet. I could ship drugs to her, make hella more money than I could make here. Real easy, right? But she was soon arrested. They intercepted her package. The feds picked her up, and she rolled over on everybody. My kids went to school one day, and around 9 o'clock, the feds knocked on my door. I was like, God. No state in America has taken more aggressive action to reduce the public's exposure to chemicals and to secondhand smoke than California. California banned the sale of flavored tobacco because it appeals to children and the use of smokeless tobacco in the state's 5 professional baseball stadiums. It prohibited the use of e-cigarettes in government and private workplaces, restaurants, bars, and casinos. San Francisco in late 2020 banned cigarette smoking in apartments. In the fall of 2020, California outlawed companies from using in cosmetics, shampoos, and other personal care products 24 chemicals it had deemed dangerous. And yet, breathing secondhand smoke and being exposed to trace chemicals in your shampoo are hardly sufficient to kill. By contrast, hard drug use is both a necessary and sufficient cause to kill, as the 93,000 overdose and drug poisoning deaths of 2020 show. And yet, where the governments of San Francisco, California, and other progressive cities and states stress the remote dangers of cosmetics, pesticides, and secondhand smoke, they downplay the immediate dangers of hard drugs, including fentanyl. In 2020, San Francisco even paid for 2 billboards promoting the safe use of heroin and fentanyl, which had been created by the Harm Reduction Coalition. The first had a picture of an older African-American man smiling. The headline read, "Change it up. Injecting drugs has the highest risk of overdose, so consider snorting or smoking instead." The second billboard's photograph was of a racially diverse group of people at a party smiling and laughing. The headline read, "Try not to use alone. Do it with friends. use with people, and take turns. When I asked Kristen Marshall of the Harm Reduction Coalition, which oversees San Francisco's overdose prevention strategy, about the threat posed by fentanyl, she said, "People use it safely all the time. This narrative that gets it labeled as an insane poison where you touch it and die, that's not how drugs work. It's not cyanide. It's not uranium. It's just a synthetic opioid, but one that's on an unregulated market." Said the Harm Reduction Services Director from Glide Memorial Church, "People have used fentanyl for years and not come to harm. We can't be shaming, stigmatizing, sensationalizing. We just have to educate people that overdoses are reversible." Glide is one of San Francisco's largest homeless service providers and had $4.8 million in active contracts with the city in 2020. In 2020, when the city government put homeless people in hotel rooms to prevent the spread of COVID-19, it also pursued a harm reduction approach. That approach included delivering residents prescription drugs, medical marijuana, and alcohol bought by private donors. Tom Wolf tweeted about it, and the program made national news. When you walk inside those single-resident occupancy hotels for the homeless, they have all kinds of drug paraphernalia for you to use, Tom said. Most people think, oh, clean needles and tourniquet, but giving away crack pipes and foil? Smokers of fentanyl sprinkle the substance on small strips of aluminum foil and heat the foil with a lighter until the fentanyl turns into smoke, which they inhale with straws. "There's a criticism of harm reduction," acknowledged Marshall, "that sometimes we even give them the drugs, but it's part of a much bigger picture. The roots of the problem," said Marshall, "are displacement, poverty, and structural racism." When I asked homelessness advocate Paul Bowden whether he thought it was okay for taxpayers to subsidize meth pipes, he suggested I was being hypocritical for not questioning the tax deduction that corporations claim for providing healthcare to their employees. "It sounds like you're suggesting that providing meth pipes for people is the same as providing healthcare," I said. "Providing meth pipes is the same as providing healthcare," he said. "I think people are killing themselves with these drugs, and anything that we can try, anything that we can do, and if it doesn't work, do something else, try something else, but I'm not going to sit there and throw rocks at a group." Not everybody I interviewed was aware of how much drug overdose deaths had risen. That included Bill Zimmerman, the political consultant who helped pass the 1996 Medical Marijuana Ballot Initiative, the 2000 Drug Treatment Instead of Incarceration Initiative, and the 2004 initiative that taxed millionaires for mental health. I worked with Bill on drug decriminalization, the death penalty, and criminal justice reform in the late 1990s, and we have remained on friendly terms ever since. We spoke by phone in late 2020. "So you know," I said, "drug overdose deaths increased from about 17,000 to over 70,000 in the last 20 years. "Oof," said Zimmerman, "that's horrible." "Had you heard that?" I asked. "No," he said, "I had not." I asked Monique Tula of the Harm Reduction Coalition, "Is there a national, state, or city strategy anywhere to reverse the rise in overdose deaths?" Without hesitating, she said, "No." She then added, "One of the things we'll be working on next year is pulling together a coalition to create a national harm reduction strategy." In late 2020, I asked Supervisor Raphael Mandelman if San Francisco had a strategy to deal with rising overdose deaths. "Not that is clear to me," he said. Today, when San Francisco, Seattle, and Los Angeles firefighters or police rescue someone from overdose with Narcan, the person is often put right back into the open drug scene and not offered drug treatment. "The way our city is doing harm reduction does not work," said Vicky Westbrook. "It's not like they give you clean needles and works and talk to you about what it could look like to be clean or get your life back. Harm reduction is like life support. It keeps people alive, but it doesn't give them their life back." Tom says that while harm reduction workers gave him the equipment for using heroin, nobody once offered him drug treatment. If I had walked in off the street to get rehab, there was maybe a 20% chance that I could have gotten a detox bed that day, and an 80% chance that it could take me up to 3 weeks to actually get into treatment, said Tom. If I get turned away that day back to the street, and in those 3 weeks, who knows what's going to happen? Possibly overdose and death. A detox bed is merely the first step to getting clean. Because opiates in particular can have dangerous withdrawal symptoms, medically assisted detox is recommended to slowly wean an addict off of them. The process requires close medical supervision and can take over a week. After detox, recovering addicts need 2 to 6 weeks of transitional support services before living in a recovery home, formerly called halfway houses, for 3 to 6 months. Tom said there were about 15 sanctioned beds for detox made available by the Department of Public Health. The Salvation Army has detox beds available, he said, but the city actually discourages you from going to the Salvation Army because it's a faith-based organization, so there's really nowhere to go for treatment. Is the reason for the lack of drug treatment that the United States lacks a single-payer healthcare system like Medicare for All? Or the Canadian system? There may be good reasons for such a system. But Canada has a single-payer system, and yet the West Coast province of British Columbia has seen overdose deaths increase 74%, from 984 deaths in 2019 to 1,716 deaths in 2020. Like San Francisco, Seattle, and Los Angeles, British Columbia's most populous city, Vancouver, embraced decriminalization, harm reduction, and housing first. And most homeless addicts in the United States are destitute, and thus already eligible for government-funded Medicaid, so a single-payer system might not have mattered. Despite skyrocketing overdose death rates, none of the country's leading advocates of harm reduction are rethinking their advocacy of decriminalization and harm reduction. Instead, they focus on things like promoting Narcan. It's really about getting emergency responders to carry naloxone, Narcan, said Ethan. The guy who was a real pioneer in all of this was a guy named Dan Big out of Chicago. He really took this issue by the horns in the early 2000s. What happened to him? He himself died of an overdose a few years ago, said Ethan. Big's death in 2018 attracted national media attention. The substances found in his body included heroin, 2 benzodiazepines, methadone, fentanyl, and acetylfentanyl, wrote a journalist for Vice. The cause of Big's death, however, in no way repudiates the cause to which he devoted his life. Leaders of the Harm Reduction Coalition agreed. We can't end overdoses until we end poverty, said Kristen Marshall, until we end racism, and until we end homelessness. For several years in the early 2010s, a UCLA sociologist named Neil Gung studied 2 very different drug treatment programs in larger Los Angeles. One was in Skid Row in downtown, and the other in Malibu, an affluent coastal community just north of L.A. The Skid Row Treatment Center was funded by the 2004 Mental Health Services Act, which taxes the state's millionaires and raised nearly $2 billion in 2019 alone. The Malibu Drug Treatment Facility was privately funded. Gong discovered something surprising. The Malibu Drug Treatment Program was far harder on its elite clientele than the Skid Row program was on the downtrodden. On Skid Row, wrote Gong, the public providers offer some difficult clients a surprising level of freedom to refuse medication, continue substance use, or act in socially deviant ways. Gong found fatalism at the Skid Row treatment characterized by an acceptance that rehabilitation is unlikely. Social workers gave private rooms to addicts if they were difficult, effectively rewarding bad behavior. Clients deemed too difficult for other agencies or who had done poorly in structured settings were offered independence and a surprising freedom, he wrote, to engage in ostensibly problematic behaviors. Psychiatrists have long warned against giving money to the mentally ill homeless addicted to drugs, and yet that is what San Francisco, Los Angeles, and other progressive cities do. It is not only clinically incorrect, said the director of psychiatric services at San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic, but almost sadistic to give money on a regular basis to people who have a demonstrated inability to handle cash funds. Gong found that leniency toward drug and alcohol abuse could result in death by overdose. One day, social worker Carlos confided in me that they had wanted to schedule a longtime street drinker in her 50s for more visits, to try and connect with her and encourage her to drink less, wrote Gong. Carlos feared he would find her dead, and indeed, a year after my fieldwork, they found her unresponsive. Many people in recovery from addiction say they would have died had they not been forced to accept treatment. I don't recommend it as a way to get your life together, said Vicky. But getting indicted by the feds worked for me. I wouldn't have done this without them. I didn't go to treatment to get clean. I went to treatment to get out of Santa Rita jail. After the police came for her in a Tenderloin hotel, Tracy Helton Mitchell hid under the stairwell. I didn't need much room, she said. Starved by daily drug use, I was a walking skeleton. Underneath my three t-shirts, you could see all my ribs. I pushed my body into the crawl space. As I crouched in the enveloping dust, trying not to cough, a rat ran past me. I was done. Even so, she said, they had to drag me into recovery in handcuffs. If I did not complete the program, I would automatically be sentenced to 3.5 years in state prison. What's happened in these places, San Francisco, Seattle, and Portland, is just the removing of all pressure, said Keith Humphreys. The thinking was, oh, people will just show up automatically and go into treatment. But that doesn't happen very often in addiction. Usually there's pressure. Research finds that many addicts need mandatory treatment, and that it works nearly as well as voluntary treatment. Noted a team of researchers, patients who have been forced to enter a substance abuse treatment have shown during and post-treatment results that are quite similar to those shown by supposedly internally motivated patients. Other research finds that mandated drug treatment through specialized drug courts aimed at addressing the underlying cause of crime, addiction, is effective in reducing drug use and recidivism, or repeat offending. One study concluded that people sentenced through drug courts were 2/3 less likely to be rearrested than individuals prosecuted through the normal criminal justice system. Another study found that a group of participants in drug courts had its rate of recidivism lowered from 50% to 38%. Researchers estimated that every dollar allocated to drug courts saves approximately $4 in spending on incarceration and health care. Today, many progressives advocate for the decriminalization of all drugs, including heroin, meth, and fentanyl. They propose that cities build special facilities where people can inject or smoke heroin, meth, and fentanyl. Said GLIDE's director of harm reduction, we're not going to get beyond the opioid deaths until we get to safe consumption sites. There's really no downside except for people who see it as a moral failing and they're morally outraged. But the people who have recovered from addiction aren't so sure. How compassionate is it to let somebody just shoot dope the rest of their life? Asked Vicky. If you hold people accountable, but you don't give them an opportunity to change their life, that's just punitive. But if you give them opportunities without holding them accountable, which is what we do now, that's not going to work either. Legalization, they fear, would result in even more overdose deaths. If they had legalized drugs or they decriminalized everything, said Tom, and made it a lot easier to get fentanyl on the street when I was on the street in 2018, I would be dead, because there would have been no real compulsion for me to stop. In early 2021, Penguin published a book by a Columbia University professor of psychology describing, defending, and to some extent, advocating his recreational use of heroin, titled Drug Use for Grown-Ups. The author, Carl L. Hart, argues that he and others should have the freedom to use heroin and meth without restriction, and that fears of heroin are overblown. Keith Humphreys disagrees. I would ask any person to sit down and graph the overdose rate for heroin and the overdose rate for cannabis, Humphreys said, and struggle for more than a nanosecond with why they are different. After thousands of years of usage, there is no recorded case of a person dying from overdose of marijuana. Meanwhile, noted Humphreys, we're having funerals all over the country for heroin. I tried to represent Hart's argument, but they would say, okay, but if heroin were legal, like OxyContin, said Humphreys, like alcohol, I said, some would say maybe at a safe injection site to avoid contaminants. If it is really true that the problem is contaminants, said Humphreys, that opioids are not being made and distributed under tight regulation by legal manufacturers, then no one would ever have died from OxyContin. It is weird to me to hear people who think of themselves as leftists slinging a line that the most shameless corporate attorney for Purdue Pharma would be embarrassed to raise in court. Because that was what they said, right? OxyContin's not dangerous. Give it as much as you want. There's no risk of addiction or overdose. That is just the same rhetoric over again. Humphreys stressed he favored harm reduction when appropriate, but that it wasn't the only response required to addiction. The first statement by any White House that naloxone, Narcan, should be widely distributed was written by me when I worked for President Obama, he said. That's harm reduction. And there's no contradiction between that and saying, I don't think a heroin industry would be a good thing. I'm all fine and good for harm reduction. I don't want anyone to die. I work in healthcare for a reason. I don't want Purdue Pharma to sell cocaine because I am for harm reduction.